Hello and welcome to another episode of Equipping the Corps. PEO Land Systems is the only program executive office in the Marine Corps and is located aboard Marine Corps Base Quantico. POLS is a Department of the Navy assigned senior executive tasked directly by ASNRDA with providing direct executive oversight to the Marine Corps' largest ground programs. The PEO is dedicated to developing, delivering, and sustaining lethal capabilities for our Marines. As the Corps undertakes its greatest modernization in a generation, the PEO is playing a critical role in fielding modern cutting-edge technologies. With several program managers fielding, managing, and sustaining a variety of systems, to include the amphibious combat vehicle, a revolutionary radar system called Gator, the Common Aviation Command and Control System, the Marine Air Defense Integrated System, as well as the current LAV and its future replacement. Overall, the portfolio includes major defense acquisition programs and associated programs with an estimated value of $7.5 billion across the future year's defense programs. The PEO recently retired, but today I am joined by the Deputy PEO, Mr. Rob Cross. Rob, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today. Before we get started, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you ended up here within our acquisition family?
Sure. Great. Thanks for getting to do this, I guess. After graduating with a mechanical engineering degree from the University of Virginia, I was hired into the Topside Composites Group at the Naval Surface Warfare Center Carter Rock Division. And I worked there for 8 years, obviously on a variety of composite projects and programs. It kind of culminated when I was the lead engineer on the advanced enclosed mast and sensor system on the LPD-17. So those two octagonal things sticking on the back of the LPD-17, I got to design those. That was kind of a highlight, good way to go out. There and from that position, I was hired directly into PM AAA, where I was initially the hull lead for what then was the Advanced Amphibious Assault Vehicle.
I appreciate that. How long have you been with the Marine Corps on this side of the house?
Yeah, ballpark? So I came to September of '99. Okay.
It's been a couple years.
Couple years.
Yeah. We'll leave it off at that. So first off, I want to dive right into and ask the question: why a PEO, and what's the difference between, a PEO and what we do here at Marine Corps Systems Command?
Yeah. It's kind of an interesting question because I think. Anywhere else in the DoD acquisition enterprise, that would be kind of a confusing question because typically SISCOMs and POs have different roles.
Right.
The PO is really where, at least in the Navy, certainly Air Force and Army, that's where the program management happens. And the SISCOM is really all of the supporting activity to include certainly the people, the processes, the tech authority, the contracting authority, fiscal authority, all the sort of supporting elements of acquisition come from a SISCOM. So, that's kind of the normal way. Certainly here in the Marine Corps, we always like to be a little bit different. So SISCOM obviously manages a large number of programs under the PFMs and, of course, the DIRPM. So it's a little bit different. So within the program management side, there's nothing particularly different that the PO does than the SISCOM programs do from a cost schedule performance.
Right.
There are some statutory requirements with respect to the ACAB ones. The MDAPs are required to be managed under a PO. All that came out of the old Goldwaters-Nichols Act and the NDA of '99. So that's kind of the statutory definition of why POs exist, which is really an effort to minimize the levels of leadership and oversight between a program manager and the ultimate decision authority.
And just for clarification, the ACAT levels basically represent the amount of money that's tied to a particular program. So obviously the ACAT 1 and 2 are the largest, most expensive programs that are being managed or led. So speaking of programs, can you give us a quick update of your portfolio? I mean, there's lots going on with that portfolio. I had recently had a conversation with Colonel Tim Howe over at PM AAA, so we got a good insight as to what he's doing over there. But can you touch on the programs and where you're at?
Yeah, sure. So I would say the current, you know, the PO's mission is probably, it's kind of significantly morphed over the last, well, really since I've been over there as the deputy for the last 3+ years, really kind of went from a focus on vehicles, you know, tactical and combat vehicles, with some additional kind of aviation program, to really aviation being the focus. And so now we're really, and I'll go through the individual programs, but at a top level, we kind of have all the systems involved in integrated air and missile defense, and then in addition we have the combat vehicle, so you know, the ACV and the LAV family of vehicles. And so going back to the integrated air missile defense, you know, that's really become a focus of the PO, so much so that we've really completely redone our advanced technology group, which was very focused on automotive and vehicle things.
Right.
And now we've, through some hiring and some, you know, moving some folks around, we've much more of a focus on that integrated air missile defense mission, because frankly, we see that this is our primary contribution to the Commandant's goal of greater naval integration of the Marine Corps and the Navy. And, you know, with the relatively recent fielding of CEC-2S and Gator, the Marine Corps really has something to offer in that greater IAMD mission, both with the Naval Force, but also the Joint Force. Mm-hmm. And I can touch on some of those. So if we step through some of the programs, you've got inside the Air Command and Control Sensor Netting PM, you have the Common Aviation Command and Control, or CAC-2S, which has been fully fielded for the last year or so. Their focus of the last couple of years for new capability, one has been fielding CC2S to all the amphibs, so what's referred to as CC2S afloat. And that's actually a program that's funded and really managed out of the Navy now, but was born out of an experiment, an opportunity where the team put a version of CC2S on an amphib just as an experiment to see if it could support certain things. And it was so beneficial to that ship commander that we never got our stuff back.
He just kept it.
And convinced the Navy and PO Integrated Weapons System, or PO IWS, to fund actually properly implementing the CC2S capability on all of the big decks. And it really allows them to communicate better with the F-35 and with the ground forces ashore. So it's been a big win all the way around. And, you know, we always like it when somebody else brings money to the table. So that works.
Oh, absolutely. I heard a lot of praise for that program. I remember several years ago having some personal knowledge of that. But yeah, the Marine Corps doing what the Marine Corps is doing. We went out and built it. We loaned it and and then we lost it.
Right.
We made it up. But it's turned out to be a great story.
Yeah. So that's a great success story for the team. And they continue. They'll be, I think, within the next year, filling to the last big deck. Meanwhile, with you know, the force design and the establishment of the MLRs, or the Marine
Littoral Regiments, right.
There's a need for a smaller footprint version of CC2S. So from that was born this concept of a small form factor CC2S. So, you know, right now CC2S is a couple of on a couple of Humvees. It'll migrate to a couple of JLTVs at some point, but it's fairly big footprint. Lot, you know, depending on, it can be bigger than that depending on at what level it's being implemented.
Right.
You know, lots of computers, lots of screens, big tents, the whole nine yards. You know, to set up a full aviation command and control center. But with in the advent of the MLRs, there's need for a smaller version of CC2S. So the team is moving out on a small form factor version. In fact, we just had a brief today. So they've done the requirements decomposition over the last 6 months to, you know, how do we give the Marine Corps something that it can use that's smaller, given that we don't have shrink rays just yet,
right?
So,
right.
So how do we get this capability to put it on a ULTV, you know, and it'll be a fighting pair of ULTVs, but how do we give them the capability and what do they need? Because obviously you can't literally have everything that comes to the fight with a full CC2S. So that's been, you know, some of the challenge and some of the things we're working with both CD&I and the fleet on is to truly understand that requirement. So the team has done some great work with Crane, coming up with a smaller data
that's
module.
Crane, Indiana, the
warfare center up there.
Right.
And hope to have some of that initial offering of just the data module out to the fleet later this year. Have somewhere between 5 and 6 of them that we can experiment, have the fleet experiment, plug their own radios and monitors and everything into it so they can start exploring and experimenting with what that greater footprint can be so that we can fully understand and then integrate those capabilities into a full-up small form factor CC2S and deliver it in the 2025 timeframe. So that's kind of where that program is going. And really those are the focuses of AC2SN. Within the GATOR program or the Ground Air Task Oriented Radar program, they are in production, they're in fielding, dealing with all the challenges that you have in early fielding with respect to parts just informed mortality things. But really doing a good job supporting the fleet. And everywhere the GATOR has gone, it always impresses and fills a gap. And in fact, you know, has giving the Marine Corps just a tremendous amount of capability, you know, today in the fight kind of capability. But the Marine, we're not sort of satisfied with that. There's a lot of work going on to take GATOR even further.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I understand you're looking to increase the numbers of GATORs that you were originally planning to.
Yeah, so there's not so much originally. The original AO was higher because it included the air traffic control radars.
Oh, gotcha.
They
gotcha.
Were never funded gotcha. In the program. So it was sort of part of the baseline, part of the original CDD, but never a funded part of the program. Until potentially now, there is an initiative in the unfunded priority list mm-hmm. for an additional number of GATORs to fill that requirement. We of course don't know yet
if that's been
funded, but that would allow the procurement of an additional set of GATORs to fill that requirement. But in addition, there are other UPLs or initiatives in the UPL list that would fund increases in capability for GATOR that are going to be very helpful. And so, you know, we can't get into all of those, but they really go after some of the performance, some of the survivability, and just will continue to make GATOR a more valuable asset to the Marine Corps.
I think if I may, one of the things that's really fascinating about that radar is that it really replaced 5 legacy systems into one.
Yeah, I mean, so from that standpoint, a tremendous value and capability for the Marine Corps. But I think what we're seeing is as we participate in a variety of experiments with other services in that integrated air missile defense sort of family, everywhere GATOR goes, it impresses. It's interesting. We just did a flight test with the Army where GATOR served as the sensor and then working back through the command and control system, CC2S, and then the composite tracking network, the antenna, or CTN, connected through back to the Army's fire control capability to launch a Patriot missile. So,
wow, that's fascinating. That's awesome.
We're really making great strides moving towards the idea of the joint all-domain command and control, or the JADC2. So it's been really exciting. But everywhere we take GATOR, its ability to keep tracks, see targets, just wows everybody. And in fact, we just essentially sold a Gator to the Air Force to use it at their test range because of they were just so impressed with its capability. So, you know, the Marine Corps, it really just opens a lot of doors for the Marine Corps, quite frankly.
That's awesome.
Into these various various forums and it's we just have to something to offer.
Yeah, it's great to see that program where it is because, as you know, in a past life of mine, it, you know, very expensive program, and it's often, you know, frugal service that we are. We like to be good stewards of taxpayers' dollars, but it's challenging. If you want the capabilities and the quality, you're going to have to pay the price. But it's great to see the work that they've done and the achievements that that radar has had.
Well, and I think it's an interesting, you know, it's interesting you say that because I think that's, you know, certainly Gator isn't unique, right? In
right,
the fact
right.
that I think in all of the programs that have been game changers, been sort of big leap forward, you know, whether you're talking CDC-2S, I mean, it had certainly plenty of challenges as Gator did, as another program we'll talk about in a little bit, I think. But the reality is that's the nature of these advanced tech programs, right? You always put a plan together that's sort of success oriented. And then when the realities of those technical challenges raise themselves, you know, you can't plan for that. So then it just has the perturbations it has. And as we, you know, as we migrate back to this peer threat environment, mm-hmm. You know, the idea of these COTS based programs, they've been great, very successful, and served the needs of the time. But I see us moving back into that, you know, more significant development programs, not maybe immediately today, but as
right.
we progress,
right.
you know, you're going to have programs like hypersonic missile programs and these highly technically complex programs that are going to have failures and are going to have challenges. And, you know, but the reality is, if you want the great thing that comes out the back mm-hmm. end, like Gator is proving to be, right. you've kind of got to be willing to put up with some of those things. So, yeah, so that takes us to the last piece of kind of the aviation side of our world, which is the MADIS, which is, or actually I should say the Ground-Based Air Defense program manager who manages the MADIS program, which is the Marine Air Defense Integrated System, and which is really a portfolio of systems that all do counter-air, counter-UAS capability, and using similar technologies, all again back to a very COTS or if not COTS fully developed, but integrated in such a way to provide a capability either from a mobile standpoint like L-MADIS and what will be MADIS, which was the ULTV or the UTV version, which is the light MADIS, moving to the MADIS, which is the currently the ACAT-2 program of record, which will be installed on the JLTV, so a larger capability, more diverse, and gets up into the Group 3, which you've got some fixed and rotary wing as well as the UAS. So you've got the MADIS program, and that's moving out. They just went through their Milestone B. They're pressing. They've got a prototype pretty well put together down at NIWC, mm-hmm. so that's exciting, down at the Warfare Center down there. And again, a diverse portfolio program. They're experimenting with counter UAS as a service for installations, which is pretty exciting. Good opportunity, especially, you know, when you go to all the sites that need protection, they don't necessarily have, you know, the air defenders there.
Right,
they have
right.
security personnel.
Right.
So how do we provide that capability without, you know, trained kind of air defenders? So capability as a service is an interesting option there. So they'll continue to work again on the MADIS program, the program of record, looking for great things there. And then there's another program that they're working that really ties into that integrated air missile defense, which is the medium range intercept capability, okay. or MRIC. Right now it's a mid-tier acquisition program. It's a prototyping effort, but extremely exciting. We've done a number of tests. We actually finished a FireX in December with live fire with a variety of incoming missiles, doing essentially different approach angles and whatnot. And MADIS, even though it's a relatively inexpensive system based on the fact that it uses our Gator, it right. uses our CC2S, and then we couple that with the relatively inexpensive Israeli missile, the Tamir, which is part of the Iron Dome, and then we use the battle management capability portion of Iron Dome. You can cobble those systems together and generate a really impressive capability that really have impressed us as we've gone through. You know, the Tamir is, you know, it's used by Israel in their particular conflict. It's not really being used against high-end threats. But it turns out it has pretty impressive capability, and we continue to learn more about that. So that's what the prototyping efforts to do, is to evaluate that, to see how far it can get us with respect to the full, you know, missile defense requirements of the Marine Corps. So more to come. Kind of the whole purpose of that is to gain information for the Marine Corps to make an informed decision here in the next couple of years on where it wants to go. Because obviously, again, when you talk about the peer threat, I mean, missile defense is we kind of got out of that business for a while, right?
We didn't
have a true threat to worry about. Probably, you know, certainly not in the desert. We didn't. But you know, certainly, you know, with China and Russia back on the radar, it's a much bigger problem. So it's an exciting program. More to come on that.
So it's interesting you talk about GBAT. If I could just make a couple of quick, what you just explained, it kind of goes back to their genetics, because they really started doing evaluation of things that, what's in the realm of possible with systems that existed, and how could we take those systems and make them do the things we need to do, particularly in the counter UAS aspect of it, and now it's grown to the missile defense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that whole program office has really done a remarkable job, and they actually grew out of the Gator program, interestingly enough.
Wow.
You know, tremendous job of just, like you said, taking what's available and creating a capability out of it that could be deployed and can protect Marines. So, you're right. You know, that's a place where the Marine Corps has got a tremendous amount of capability with very little investment from a development standpoint. You know, where that, you know, truly integration type programs versus development program, which kind of leads to the vehicle programs, the other two programs. So to start with PM-AAA, Advanced Amphibious Assault, who have the ACV and the AAV. As you mentioned, you just talked to Tim Howe, so you got the full rundown on, you know, what they're up to. But certainly, you know, everybody understands the AAV has been around a long time. The challenges with it, obviously, we had the tragic sinking, you know, a year ago. And so there's that much more emphasis and you know, interest in getting the ACVs out there as fast as possible. And so Tim and his group are absolutely focused on that. Again, just like Gator, dealing with all of the challenges that a new fielding, you know, runs into, you know, those initial, hey, you know, this worked great in testing, we give it in the hands of Marines, and all of a sudden something goes a little sideways. So they're working through all that smartly, and, you know, just recently awarded the lots 2 through 4 contract. Mm-hmm. So that was a big milestone. You know, that will buy out all the personnel variants and all the command variants, which is a big deal. The next two variants, the gun variant, which is the 30mm gun variant,
and the
recovery variant, are in development right now. So they're working with BAE on that development effort, and it so far it's going, you know, the gun variant is going very well, the testing there. The R variant is sort of in concept development. We're doing some experimentation with it, but that's a little more you know, sort of immature, but moving along to meet the timeline. So that's really, you know, again, as Tim, I'm sure, went into greater detail, you know, everything's kind of moving along well. You know, they are learning all the joy that comes from moving from a competitive environment to a sole source environment when it comes to contracting, right? So, you know, that program was really well designed, and I think Mr. Garner, you know, should get a lot of credit for the way that program was designed and the competition that was built in to that program, and the way that they got a lot of the production pricing up till now was in a competitive environment, and the Marine Corps certainly benefited from that. So now we're in a sole source environment, and you have to be, you know, a little bit more creative and figure out how to still get the Marine Corps a good deal, you know, in a fair return on its investment, but do it in a sole source environment. So they're working through those things.
So I got to ask you, I got to take you back in time, because, you know, this inevitably was coming. You and I share a past in a different system, different platform that kind of led up to this. I mean, it's no secret. We worked DFV and followed on to MPC and then, you know, to what it is today. And I know, based on my personal experience with you, you had quite a hand in several chapters of this program. So I got to ask you, how does it feel? You're in full rate production. You saw it in its infancy. You saw the, you know, some of the almost successes and some of the failures and some of the other systems. But, you know, it's come full circle. It's out there now.
Yeah. So, I mean, first and foremost, it's certainly great to give the Marine Corps and give the, you know, the Amtrakers, even if they may be Amtruckers now, it's hard to know, but it's certainly great to finally give the Marine Corps a new vehicle to replace the, right. the venerable AAV, which has done an amazing job,
but
frankly, you know, has its struggles being relevant on the modern battlefield, right? Let's be honest about that. So
look, I won't show my age, but you know, if it does as well as I've done, I don't know. It's right. time to move on.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So from that point, great, but you know, certainly a little bittersweet, from a perspective of, you know, short of coming up with the actual name amphibious combat vehicle.
Right.
Cause you know, I just didn't think the NAV was going to make it happen. The new amphibious vehicle, which is what it was, what is originally, coined. So other than that, you know, I led the program through its original, the ACV program, that is, when it was still a tracked vehicle. I led that through the MDD milestone. And then, you know, went off and did the high water speed study with Dr. Burrow and then kind of departed the pattern.
Right.
And it was really after that, you know, the program and really John Garner and gang kind of plotted a path on how to kind of revive MPC, which had sort of been kind of killed off briefly.
And MPC was the Marine Personnel.
Yeah, which looks a lot like an ACV.
Correct.
So they kind of revised that and it was the right vehicle for, you know, what the Marine Corps needed at the time. But again, and you know, all the credit for that program really goes, you know, Mr. Garner for his visionary to put that program in place that has really executed within months or weeks of what the original plan was. And you have folks like, you know, Colonel Mullins, who led as a PDM for ACV then as the PM. So he had a long, you know, a big chunk of that where his leadership was critical. You know, you go back to Angelo Scalardo, who was one who was very influential in the early phase and kind of a great teammate to Colonel Mullins. And all the way back to Mike Ulrey, who spans back to the MPC time with Mark Paquette, who, again, did a phenomenal job. And it was really the efforts of Mark and Mike who really did that industry outreach and kind of put the information in place that allowed the Marine Corps to make a decision to go with ACV. So all those folks really, really get all the credit for that program. You know, I came along in the PEO at a point where, you know, I got to help in the production decisions and certainly, and you know, that was great and got to support those folks and work with them in a variety of ways. But yeah, this is, you know, certainly for anyone that's been laboring, has ever been in AAA over the last 20 years who, you know, feel like we've been trying to replace that darn AAV for a long time. It's satisfying, you know. It's, you know, again, at the end of the day, it's not quite as cool as the idea of Marines getting the water ski behind their Amtrak.
Right.
There'll be none of that. But
well, I won't tell you where I was in 99 when those decisions initially came up. So,
but certainly it's a great thing for the Marine Corps and it's exciting.
Awesome.
So I guess to transition real quick, transition back to LAV.
Absolutely. I was just going to go down that road. I know you inherited that program here, what, 6 or so months ago,
it's been a little bit more than a year ago, I think, now. And it moved over really, obviously, there's the legacy LAV, and the team up there is doing a great job keeping that
they're up in Detroit, right?
In Detroit, Michigan. Right. And they're keeping it up and running. It's still a critical asset. And frankly, with the tanks out of the formations, mm-hmm. you know, the LAV-25, that's kind of the only significant caliber weapon the Marine Corps has at the moment. So they're still in great demand. But the reason really that LAV came to the PO is the potential for the Advanced Reconnaissance Vehicle, or the ARV. So that's a pre-MDAP program. Right now, it's actually being run as a mid-tier acquisition prototyping effort. And that'll run. We've got two vendors with both it's GD and Textron are building prototypes that will be evaluated. And essentially, the way I look at it, an AOA was done for the ARV. And, you know, that's sort of the government's, you know, chance to evaluate the options. And the Marine Corps sort of down selected to either a new start vehicle, which is what the mid-tier prototyping effort is looking at, or a variant of the ACV. And so we have a separate study going on in parallel to the mid-tier acquisition effort to explore what that might look like and what that might cost. And all of that is being done for a Marine Corps decision in 23 to decide what the future of really, is there a requirement for a vehicle for Marine Corps reconnaissance? And if so, what of these two paths appear to be the most promising? And you know, then we'll be prepared to step off smartly, whichever of those two is selected.
And that's really what the AOA, the alternative analysis of alternatives, will eventually help inform.
I guess to finish that thought. So there was the AOA, which was the government's attempt to answer the question of what the Marine Corps needs. So now the mid-tier is allowing industry to get it, you know, to kind of take their best swing, whether that be BAE in explaining what an ACV version might look like, or GD or Textron, hey, here's how, this is how close to your requirement we can get with a new start. And so it takes it from sort of this analytical approach to more like hardware. We're going to, there'll be prototypes, we'll get to do a little bit of testing. And so it allows the Marine Corps to make a much more informed decision versus, you know, prior to initiating a program of record. So, and really we feel like that is, you know, that's in many ways what the mid-tier prototyping authorities are really there for, you know, to be a, make fully informed decisions before you launch into a program.
Well, that's great. I mean, it seems like you're not only doing great things with fielding, but you got your hands full just around the corner. And I know you mentioned, you talked a while back about doing a lot of collaboration with the Army and the other services. What are your relationships like? Do you connect with the other services on a regular basis?
Yeah, so on a couple of different levels, yes. First and foremost, we have from a you know, recurring basis, that one of the functions we've created an integrated air missile defense cell of sorts within the PEO. John Stroud kind of leads it. Roy Barnhill is really kind of the full-time lead, if you will. And then we had a gentleman named Jason Elliott, who we hired, who had 20 years of Aegis experience. We actually just recently deployed him to Gator to help them out. But really, with that team, they serve as the Marine Corps rep to a number of you know, integrated air and missile defense working groups that are either DON level or, you know, DOD level. And so that keeps us engaged and keeps us talking in where we can, you know, sort of advertise, if you will, what the Marine Corps is bringing to the table these days. And that has resulted in, you know, I mentioned the FT-6 with the Army, you know, various tests with the Army. We've done tests with the Navy to show how, you know, Navy ships can use the Gator radar tracks, you know, through CAC-2S to engage targets. So through those bodies, we're really sort of advocating to get the Marine Corps' foot in the door in this world. And it's been very successful. So those are kind of the recurring basis. Obviously, through a number of these demos, we've worked very closely with PO IWS, both IWS-C and then IWS-2 as well, are two of the primary folks within there that we collaborate quite a bit with. But we also work with the Strategic Capabilities Office on a variety of things to look at innovative ways of implementing some of our capabilities, as well as I mentioned the Army. So PEO, Missiles in Space, is who primarily we work with in the Army. And, you know, it's all been very successful. I mean, the exciting thing is we've done these demos and these experiments. In each case, our stuff is really hit it out of the park. And so we kind of keep getting invited back to more and more. Some things, we had a recent one, an interest in putting a Gator on top of an LCS. We didn't love that idea for a number of reasons, especially because they wanted to put it right next to a missile system. That seemed all bad. So, but it's great to be, you know, it really, we have the most modern radar out there, and certainly the most modern radar that isn't, you know, bolted to a ship. So, so it gets us invited to a lot of really interesting things, and so it's been exciting.
That's great. Great to hear. I know you mentioned NIWC, you mentioned Crane and a couple others. How important are the, you know, the various research facilities, and what kind of relationship do you have with some of these DOD research facilities?
Well, I think, you know, just like everyone, you know, in the command, we've the research, the Navy labs are kind of an extension of our technical workforce, right, in a lot of places. And I think certainly in some areas, like if you look at PM-AAA, I mean, there's been a relationship with Carderock. In fact, the AAAV program was born out of a project in Carderock, right? And Code 20 at Carderock is where it initiated. And that got us the program and Walt Zeifus, for those who remember Walt. He came out of Code 20.
Character in his own right, we'll leave it at that.
Right. So, you know, that's a place where we've always relied on for that hydrodynamic type support. But I know, you know, we've also relied on folks like Crane, up in Crane, Indiana. They're kind of the gun experts, so we get a lot of gun expertise. And they've also done, you know, great things for Mattis and they're now, as I mentioned, small form factor CC2S.
Right.
So that's another one. And then you talk about the NIWC. Those guys, great capability down there. And again, I think this command, we've gotten a ton of support from NIWC Atlantic. You know, we've got P. Reddy down there, who's always, he comes from here.
Former PM,
former PGD, I believe. Yep. And so, you know, Pete's just a great resource for us and always gets us great help. And you know, it certainly works to get us the A-team, which is always very helpful. I would say that, you know, I should mention Dahlgren too. I should mention Dahlgren because they, you know, first of all, we've been stealing engineers from Dahlgren like crazy because that's where all the integrated air missile defense expertise is. I mean, that's where they
close.
Grow up.
Yeah, they're 40, right 50 street, miles down the road.
Right down the street. Yeah. So it's easy to steal people because you know, commute a different direction.
Yeah.
But we also get a lot of tech support from them and range support. So Dahlgren's been great. And I would say that, the labs are going to be even more important to us as we look to the future, as we look to more technical programs, as we look to more technical solutions. And, you know, look, we all know that there's a continued downward pressure on our CIV PERS. So as we continue to get work, but we get less money to buy people,
right,
we're going to have to rely on that, it's, if you want to call it, you know, extended technical workforce more and more. And so I just see the relationships we have with the labs are going to be more and more critical. And I could, you know, I could see us get an even more of a formal relationship the way NAVC had to do it in the late 90s, when they frankly farmed out all their engineers to the labs, and because they couldn't sustain the headquarters, the numbers at the headquarters. And so we're in that same kind of crunch. So, I think they're critical.
It's fascinating because you hit on a key point. You know, relationships are key to a lot of things that we do. And I know you've got a lot of relationships with our industry partners that, because again, it has to be a partnership to get some of these capabilities to the finish line. What are you looking for from industry in the out years, and what should they be paying attention that maybe they're not paying attention to right now?
Well, I mean, to a degree, I would say they can expect more of the same. And what do I mean there? So, you know, this sort of fiscally austere environment that we're in, I mean, we've been in it for a while. And, you know, what that means to industry is industry investment, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the ways that they're helping us. Programs like the mid-tier prototyping effort for ARV, that's a joint investment. So the vendors are investing their own money with the government. And I think where you've got these significant technical programs, We're going to need, you know, those IRAD investments from industry. We're going to need them to be pushing the envelope, to be getting out ahead, to be, you know, one thing that I will give Northrop Grumman a lot of credit for is they are always pushing the envelope from a technology standpoint.
And they're the Gator radar.
Yes. Well, yeah. and a variety of things, but certainly right, Gator radar, right. F-35.
Right.
And so, you know, when the need arises, and when we become aware of that need, oftentimes we go talk to Northrop. They're already working on something that's in the same direction of where our need is, because they're looking out at what the next thing is in the technology. Now, it's obviously it's somewhat easier for them because it's very focused on a specific technological area. But you know, that's the kind of thing we need. We're gonna continue to need. I think also more innovative ways on the sustainment side. We're gonna continue to need help there. The cost of sustaining these systems is becoming more and more challenging with less and less money. And so how do we do that in a more economical way? How do they help us do that? You know, right now we, you know, they tend to be the most expensive solution. You know, they're kind of the easy button, you know,
right,
contractor
right.
logistics support, but they're also very expensive. And so certainly to the degree that they can, which often forces us away from them and to maybe less optimal sustainment approaches. So to the extent that they can figure out innovative ways to be cost effective, you know, those things are going to be beneficial. And you know, also just really, I think the other way that they're going to need to help us, we're going to need to all help ourselves. And it gets into the security side of things.
Right.
You know, that's just become such a challenging area with the IT and the sort of chip technology and everything, all the ways in which our adversaries can attack our systems. Or all, replicate them.
All roads lead to cyber somewhere.
Yeah, really do. And so that's just, you know, and they're obviously investing in that. But you know, the time of us spending all the money developing these capabilities and having our adversaries just steal it from the, you know, yeah. the hard drives yeah. of our contractors or their subcontractors right. is just, that's just eating our lunch. We've right. we got to figure that out.
Well, listen, Rob, I don't want to take up too much of your time. I, first and foremost, this has been extremely informative. And before we get to our, what many say is our favorite part of the show, I do want to ask you one final question, if I could. You've obviously spent a few years at the PEO, or maybe a few more years at the PEO. And that team has accomplished a lot, but what are some of the things that you're most proud of? I mean, what are some of the things that stand out to you? And what's on your bucket list that you still want to get done over there at the PEO?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, again, the PEO going all the way back to Mr. Taylor, you know, when there's that great picture of him at his first staff meeting, which is him sitting at a table by himself.
I remember that photo. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, you know, the PO was sort of established over the protests of the Marine Corps. Right. The Marine Corps didn't really see a great need for the PO at the time. It didn't maybe understand the role it needed to play. But, you know, since then, I think through the leadership of Mr. Taylor and then Mr. Garner, the value of the PO. And of course, you know, also, I think there was a recognition of some that the Marine Corps was getting into big programs,
right.
Some really important things. And to do that, you really do need to play at the varsity level in some of these programs. And certainly AK1, as I said, it's a statute. You need a PO to play. And the alternative is put all these big programs on their Navy POs. And, you know, there's value to that in some areas. But, you know, what we do is unique. You know, the Marine Corps is not the Navy. The Marine, you know, yes, we want to have greater naval integration, but we're not the Navy. And there's just a lot of value in having a Marine Corps PEO, because while the reporting chain is up through the Navy, while the billet is a Navy billet, make no mistake, the PEO land systems, he recognizes, he answers to the commandant, or he or she, if you see what the future holds. But certainly, this is a Marine Corps organization. It's manned by Marine Corps employees, by Marine Corps Systems Command employees, who understand the mission, who do what they do every day for Marines. And so so I think it's important when you look at the successes, you know, certainly going all the way back, you know, the the truck programs, the LVSR, the MTVR. Just the MTVR in particular, just such a great collaboration between CD&I and kind of bucking the Army and delivering just a much better vehicle, frankly, than the Army got. Or perhaps wanted or
no offense
afford.
To the Army, but I, you know, yeah, like I said, in conversations where they want our truck now.
Yeah,
but,
they, yeah. There are there have been many times in Afghanistan or Iraq where the Army has to borrow MTVRs.
Right.
They just their trucks just couldn't do what they needed to do. So, you know, the truck fleet has been great. Certainly the JLTV, you know, since I've been in the PO, and I think, you know, when Mr. Garner took over. When Stackley really placed him here, he had a mandate. He had a gauntlet of programs that needed to get over the hump mm-hmm. to production, right? Four programs were all sort of lined up at the gate.
I remember.
And you know, every one of them, he made it across the finish line. CC2S, the JLTV, the Gator, and then finally the ACV. So, I mean, I think that's a tremendous record of accomplishment for the PO, certainly for Mr. Garner, fully fulfilling his mandate. Every one of those programs got across that line either on schedule or ahead of schedule. CC2S was nearly a year ahead of schedule. The Gator, similarly, not as much ahead of schedule, but slightly ahead of schedule. So so that, I think, is, you know, because at the end of the day, it's what we all do, right? Why we're all here is to get gear in the hands of Marines, right? And so those were, you know, in the last 3+ years, 4 years for Mr. Garner, you know, four programs, getting capability, you know, incredibly needed, vital capability into the hands of Marines. So I think that's, you know, that's great. I think the fact that we're using the MTA authorities on a couple of programs, you know, up with our friends up at LAV are doing right. just great right. things with that. You know, our Mattis program. Certainly, I think with the MREC, but I think the Mattis folks are just really have to be commended for with little money, with no program of record, they just put a tremendous amount of counter UAS capability out there in the hands of Marines. You know, most famously, you know, highlighted by President Trump when they when they shot down a couple of or the Marines put, you know, the actual ship commander put the Mattis up right, on his deck
on going, the flight deck yeah.
Going,
yeah
going past Iran, and they shot down a couple of Iranian U.S. So you know, a lot of success stories. You know, as we say, you know, the motto is it's all about the warfighter. So I think the most important things are when we get capability in the hands of the warfighter. So, you know, that's kind of what I would point to.
Well, that's great. Again, I think this has been really insightful, and I really appreciate you taking the time to join us here today. Before we let you go, we got a challenging part of this effort here. I do have to ask you some difficult questions.
Right, lightning round.
So if you're ready, let's jump right into our lightning round.
All right.
What's your favorite vacation spot?
I'll go with Sandbridge. It's down near Virginia Beach. That's where our family and friends, we've been vacationing for the last several years, and it's got a little bit of everything for everybody, so we've really enjoyed it. I've gone to more exotic spots, but that's just like, it's like comfort food. It's just easy to get to.
That's
have
awesome.
A good time, so that's
well, yeah, that's our spot. Spending a lot of time on 95, I can see.
Yeah, we avoid it.
So I got to ask you, what's a TV show, book, or movie? Or a podcast.
I'm going to go recommend. Podcast.
You're going to go podcast?
I'm going to go podcast. So I'm going to recommend How Did This Get Made?
Oh, okay.
It's pretty funny. They basically talk about movies that are terrible. And so it's How Did This Get Made? And they just go through it and they take a very, they sort of revel in the greatness of how bad it was. So, but it's pretty funny. It's a couple of the guys from the show The League.
Oh, okay.
And they're just, it's just a funny show. They have guests and whatnot. So I'll recommend that. It's a little off the beat.
I'm surprised. I thought you were going to go movies because I know you're a bit of movie buff.
I am,
but we'll
you know, in the pandemic,
we'll take
movies
it.
Are kind of hard to come by. I've been waiting for, you know, Maverick for 4 years.
So if you weren't doing what you're doing now, what would Rob Cross be doing?
Yeah, who knows? I guess if not for a hiring freeze at the time, I probably, before I got the job at Carter Rock, I was essentially selected for a position at the Savannah River Project down in Aiken, South Carolina. So I would have been working on nukes this whole time, and I would be glowing at this point, presumably. And maybe I would have had some of those superpowers you're about to ask me about.
I am. You knew exactly where I was going. So little green men and everything. So if you had a superpower, what would it be?
Yeah, so strangely enough, I thought about a couple things, but I think it's going to be luck. I'm going to go to luck. You know, there was an argument, you know, in the Deadpool 2, back to movies. I referenced the movie.
Yeah.
So in Deadpool 2, the character Domino has a bit of an argument with Deadpool that her superpower is luck. He's like, that's not a superpower. She's like, yeah, it is. No, it isn't. So, but it turns out her luck pretty much carries the day. So I'm going to go with luck because you know, flying is going to get old.
Right.
And it's very solitary. Right. You can't really share it with anybody. Super strength, you're just going to be carrying everybody's couches.
I did the whole invisibility thing. That doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, invisibility's no good, right? That's boring. So you can just spy on people.
Yeah.
So, you know, these are all, they're all kind of a burden. But, you know, luck, it's just good things are going to keep happening to you, right? So
there you go. There you go.
And, you know, so I'm going to go with luck, yeah.
Well, listen, that's awesome. Again, thanks for taking the time to join us. Best of luck in the future. Maybe we'll get you back here at another day.
Who knows?
All right.
Who knows what the future holds?
Well, this concludes another episode of Equipping the Corps. I hope you've enjoyed our conversation today. If so, please take a couple minutes, leave us a review, subscribe, tell your friends about us. Till next time, Manny Pacheco signing off.